We'll be discussing the ninth sutta, the Sammaditti Sutta, which you've all noticed is quite long. So because of that, we have to enforce a rule of only three questions per person. Well, Dania, Nicholas, anyone else? Three questions. So you have to choose your questions carefully. No, there's no transfers. Otherwise, I'll be in big trouble. Okay. So here we go. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So this particular sutta is very famous. It's like used to say that meat and veg sutta. Even though maybe for vegetarians that doesn't make much sense, but it's like very straight down the line core teachings of Buddhism, mentioning things like the Four Noble Truths, the dependent origination, and in particular how that all becomes Sammaditti, the first factor of the Eightfold Path. So here we go. Thus have I heard, on one occasion a Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove, Anatta Pindika's Park. There the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus. Friends, bhikkhus, friends, they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this. So these suttas are not always the teachings of the Buddha. Mostly they are words of the Buddha, but they're also the words of very senior disciples. One of right view, one of right view. That's Sammaditti, the first factor of the Eightfold Path. One of right view is said, friends, in what way is a noble disciple one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and who has arrived at this true Dhamma? So that means the stream winner. The stream winner is known as one of right view, who is view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and also the Buddha and the Sangha. And has arrived at this true Dhamma is the, also the key to say this is a person who is a stream winner, once returned, non returned, or arahat. Indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will remember it. So if ever I ask you a question, say, what are the two types of meditation? Instead of giving an answer, you say, indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Ajahn Brahm the meaning of the statement. That's the proper way to address someone. So then, friends, listen and attain closely to what I shall say. Yes, friend, the monks replied, the Venerable Sariputta said this. So the first paragraph or section. The wholesome and the unwholesome. The wholesome is kusala and akusala. Wholesome, unwholesome is sort of okay, but many more people prefer these days the word skillful and unskillful. In other words, skillful means that it's going to be an act of body, speech, or mind, which is in line with the goal which it attained, which it is hoping to achieve. So when the aim is for nibbana, peace, happiness, whatever, that one of these is skillful, in other words, it will bring those intentions to fulfillment, and the other one is unwholesome or unskillful, in other words, it will make your aspirations blocked. So here we go. I'm going to use skillful and unskillful. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the unskillful and the root of the unskillful, the skillful and the root of the skillful, in that way they are one of right view, whose view is straight, whose unwavering confidence in the Dhamma has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what, friends, is the unskillful? What is the root of the unskillful? The skillful, the root of the unskillful. Killing living beings is unskillful. Taking what is not given is unskillful. Misconduct in sensual pleasures, that's the third precept, is unskillful. False speech is unskillful. Malicious speech is unskillful. Harsh speech is unskillful. Gossip is unskillful. Covetous is unskillful. Ill will is unskillful. Wrong view is unskillful. This is called the unskillful. And there you can see is the four precepts of killing, stealing, misconduct in sensual pleasures, which literally means, is explained as having sexual intercourse with people you should not, in other words, underage people, another person's partner, people who have mental disability, slaves, people in, you'd say even these days, in a teacher-student relationship, that is all unskillful, or in a sense it's misconduct in sexual pleasures, is unskillful. And false speech, which is lying, malicious speech, is a gossip, which I say, malicious gossip, where you use what you've heard over here to create disharmony over there. And harsh speech, again, is calling someone camel face. The gossip is like basically stupid speech, which has no purpose. It doesn't mean you don't tell jokes, because sometimes telling a joke within a talk, it is skillful because it gets people to listen. And ill will. Now we've got the three: covetous, ill will, and wrong view. Very similar to greed, hatred, and delusion. Different words, only the covetousness, the abhija, again, is a synonym for the first hindrance, so it is very, very close to sensory desire. The word covetousness is not a very good translation. Ill will is obvious, and wrong view is unskillful. This is called the unskillful. So you can see here that a right view is not knowing what wrong view is. And what is the root of the unskillful? Greed, hatred, and delusion. Lobha, dosa, moha are the root of the unskillful. This is called the root of the unskillful. And what is the skillful? And instead of actually saying anything positive, it's just abstention from these things. Abstention from killing living beings, abstention from taking what is not given, abstention from misconduct and sensual pleasures, abstention from false speech, abstention from this malicious gossip to create disharmony, abstention from harsh speech, abstention from basically useless speech, abstention from uncovetousness, non-ill will is skillful, and right view is skillful. This is called the skillful. What is the root of the skillful? Non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. That is the skillful. So these, as we mentioned yesterday, are the 10 akusalapata and the 10 kusalapata. So it's, but what is really skillful is not just abstention, but be looking after living beings. It's not just taking what's not given, abstaining from that is skillful. It's actually the opposite of taking what's not given is being generous. Instead of misconduct in sensual pleasures, as obviously using them wisely, in other words, when you have your meals, you use the sensory pleasures to digest your food but not go too much. False speech, malicious speech. Well, false speech means you tell the truth. Abstention from malicious speech, if you do tell what other people are doing, it's for the sake of harmony, looking out for their good interests. Abstention from harsh speech is always saying kind speech. So, hopefully that you think, my example of that, no matter what you do, I never say, you stupid anagarika, you idiot novice. I never say harsh speech. Whatever you do, I say very good. That's what I mean, abstention from harsh speech. And abstention from gossip, only talking when it's really necessary. And that's why as a teacher, I mean, sometimes you may think I'm a bit dismissive of you, but that's what the Buddha actually said, that he sometimes gives teachings to get rid of people. Because sometimes it's too much talking. And of course, no covetousness, non-ill will. Uncovetousness is usually a synonym for renunciation. Non-ill will is a synonym for metta, and right view is wisdom. When a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome or the unskillful and the root of the unskillful, the skillful and the root of the skillful, they entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust, abolish the underlying tendency to aversion, extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am, and by abandoning ignorance, or I could say delusion, of arousing true knowledge, they here and now make an end of suffering. In this way too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, whose unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at the true Dhamma. That paragraph is repeated. I should have actually said there that they abandon the underlying intensity, that is, it's not just underlying it for the time being, because after a deep meditation, now these are the anusayas, after a deep meditation, you can abandon such things. You know, you've got no greed, no lust, no ill will. People can call you camel face and you just smile. And you say, what a cute way they say that. Whatever it is, it means that you just cannot get angry. But that is not abolishing the underlying tendency. That is just the manifestation of these things. But abolishing the underlying tendency to these things means that they've gone forever. And the conceit, I am, which is of course a big one. And by abandoning this delusion of I am and arousing true knowledge, here and now, actually, that is one translation which I object to. It's sanditika, it means in this very life. Not here and now, but in this life. Make an end of suffering. In this way, to a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So even that is sufficient to be a stream winner. But obviously, you can see right in the middle of that, you understand right view and wrong view. That's number 10. So the right view is knowing right view. So it's a bit circuitous. It's a bit of a circular argument, but understanding those 10 things is almost qualifies you for being a stream winner. Any comment on that? Well, you're very good. Keeping.
Why
is it pre-temple the machine there? Aha! So it means it's okay to take alcohol. You can still be a stream winner. It's interesting because there was this man, Sarakani. It's in the Sanyutta Nikaya. Sarakani, who when he died, he was a very good disciple of the Buddha, but he was a drunkard. And people said, oh, what was his rebirth? You know, because, you know, he was didn't keep his five precepts. And the Buddha said he was a stream winner. They said, what? And they started to complain. These days, anyone can become a stream winner. In the old days, you had to be really good, but, you know, the standard has been lowered. But it's amazing. The Buddha said, yes, he was a stream winner, even though he took alcohol. So he had right view, but he didn't actually, hadn't really got rid of his defilements and tendencies yet. So it's interesting, that's not actually in there. However, you may say that that is taking alcohol will be part of like covetousness, desire. And it's also certainly part of delusion. It makes you deluded. But it's interesting, it's not in there. It certainly is in the five precepts, and it's certainly said elsewhere in the suttas as something which you know should not do. So, remember when you just look at one sutta, actually, then there's FWBO. Western Buddhist Order. They use this as their precepts, as their credo. And they point out, so there's no alcohol in there, so they don't mind going to the pub. Because they say, which is not unwholesome, it says it in here. However, people get into big trouble. Okay, do you want to use one of your three?
Yes.
Okay.
Like the understanding of the root, wholesome and unwholesome, as sort of like a quality of stream winner, is that knowledge that someone like that has, is that because they feel they may have these experiences and they come to understand what maybe gives leads to pain and suffering and what leads to freedom, so that they're measuring their experience to understand what that root is?
Yes, they have insight into the root. There's another sutta which comes to mind. They say, without being a stream winner, you cannot abandon these things. There's no way that you can abandon greed and hatred. So you have to get the stream winning first of all, because you don't even know what the roots truly are. So yeah, people might say, yeah, I know what ill will is. I know what sort of greed is. But they don't know its full extent. They only know its gross manifestations. That's why I said last Wednesday, when you get into some deep meditation, you find these ill will, even just ill will to where you are right now, that's a form of ill will which stops you getting peaceful, which stops you letting go. So it's understanding the more refined forms of greed, hatred and delusion, but understand them to the very core. And that will mean at least you know what the problem is, you know the disease.
And is that knowledge to the core, is it seen as painful and suffering? Is that the kind of motivation to abandon it?
That's one of them. It's seeing only of the three aspects. See that, you know, it's painful, so you get nibbida towards it. Or you see it's, you know, it's unreliable, uncertainty, that also gives you nibbida. You know, why rely on people you can't trust? And also just seeing it's none of my business. And anatta. So through any of those three lenses, you can actually abandon them.
And is seeing it as none of your business really thing that you can't control?
That's right, that's the same aspect as anicca. Basically nothing to do with me. So, you know, I want an easy life, so whatever you do when you leave here, Nicholas, that's your business. I'm not going to check up on you and tell you what to do. So that's the first power, first section, the skillful and the unskillful. Now we get to nutriments. The word nutriment is ahara. It is the same word as food in Pali. So the food which we have in the morning is called ahara. It's a nutriment because that's where the word comes from. But also it's used in a wider sense, not just food for the body, but anything which is a food for any process, its fuel source, and nutriment is a very good translation. So in good friends, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sariputta's words, then they asked him a further question. In those days you weren't limited to three questions. But friends, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands nutriment, the origin of nutriment, the cessation of nutriment, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, in that way they are one of right view who has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what is nutriment? What's its origin, the cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of nutriment? There are four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that have already come to be, and for the support of those about to come to be. What for? They are physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as the second, mental volition as the third, and consciousness as the fourth. And with the arising of craving, there is the arising of nutriment. With the cessation of craving, there is the cessation of nutriment. The way leading to the cessation of nutriment is just this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness and stillness. When a noble disciple has thus understood nutriment, the origin of nutriment, cessation, the way leading to the cessation of nutriment, they entirely abandon the underlying tendency to greed, hatred and aversion and to the view and the underlying tendency to greed and extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit I am. And by abandoning delusion, arousing true knowledge, they here and now make an end of suffering, or in this life make an end of suffering. In this way too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And so this is the first time in this sequence here where they apply to every factor of the dependent origination this framework we find mostly in the Four Noble Truths. What it is, what's its cause, its end, and the way leading to its end, just as in the Four Noble Truths. And that particular framework is used often. So, understanding that the Buddhism is focusing on things being a process, you see exactly what you're talking about. If it's a process, where does it come from? What's its cause? And you know, there's an end to it, and how does it come to an end? And interestingly, I like this point here because this is not usually mentioned in the dependent origination, but it's very beautiful because it really shows you the brilliant understanding of what keeps a being going. Physical food, obviously, that's the obvious one, but also contact, which is a sensory contact that keeps the human being going. So, if you become deaf and blind, and you can't taste or smell anything, and you lose your physical touch, the contact is gone, and you will die. It's one of the reasons why some babies become stillborn, because the sensory apparatus is not developed. But even more than that, mental volition, will, is a nutriment, is a cause of your life continuing, being maintained, and also for beings about to come to be. In other words, if you can let that go, your will, there's no cause for coming to being in a next life. And also, when you give up your will, you die. That's why it's a bit scary when I say don't do anything. Because I'm telling you to die. To take off one of these things which keeps the being going. So mental volition is the nutriment, one of the four causes which keeps you going. And you see, the more that will is, just like the more food you have, the fatter you are. The more will you have, the fatter your ego. And also consciousness, just like the contact. The conscious experience as a fourth keeps you going. Not only is a nutriment for beings already here, but for those, support of those about to come to be. So how do you stop coming to be? Stop samsara. No eating. No contact. Stop mental volition. And let go of consciousness. Because the conscious process, you can see it just keeps running on. When you're conscious of something, that consciousness creates the next consciousness. It creates this momentum. It's the food of the mind. That's why many people, they like to have more experience, more contact of life. Go and see the Great Wall of China. Go and see the latest Harry Potter movie. Go and enjoy the great restaurants of the world. Have more contact. And the more those sensory experiences you have, the more you are. The more you will, the more you are. That's why you see the teaching which I've been given you, which many of you have noticed is different maybe than others you see, very much focuses on the mental volition part. Because that is the cause of being. That keeps you going from life to life. That even makes this life having a big sense of ego. People with the biggest will have got the biggest egos. And just consciousness itself, even if you let go of volition, the consciousness will still keep you going, which is what happens in those arupa realms and the higher jhana realms. No mental volition. Contact is almost not there, it's only just one sense. No food. But what's happening there is the consciousness keeps the whole process going. It hasn't disappeared yet. Yeah?
It's the same with people who don't eat, you know, like the same food in the meat, or the requirements to eat, you know, food, is what the consciousness keeps
you going. Oh, okay, that's an interesting one. If you don't eat real food, you go on fast, what keeps you going? It probably is actually just the mind keeps you going. It's a great idea, and it's brilliant teaching of the Buddha, which is not focused on much, what keeps the body and mind going. Physical food keeps the body going, but especially this other thing keeps the mind going. Contact, will, and consciousness. So the more you indulge in consciousness, the more you strengthen your being. The more you will and strive, the more you're feeding sense of self. The more contact you have, the more you look around and enjoy the sights and sounds of the world, the more you're strengthening the sense of self, giving it more nutriment, making it fatter and stronger, so it's going to have a difficult time letting go and disappear. But a noble disciple is thus understood. I should have said, his craving is the cause of this. Craving is the cause of these nutriments. You want the food. You want the contact. You want the volition. It's interesting, isn't it? Will, it has a sense of delight to it. It's nice when you've got a sort of project to do. So you can actually exercise your will. That's why the delight for will gives the pleasure of one of the deva realms. Those who will power other people's creations, which is a very high deva realm. And that's because they just delight in the exercise of their will. It's the same reason why people, they become very rich and then they go into politics. And you think, why does a person just want, you know, they've got all the money in the world, why do they want to sort of get into politics for? You know, what turns them on? It's again that sort of control over others, the exercise of their will. And why do people actually become prison officers? Because they can control others. Anyway, so that's powerful, it's a craving. So the arising craving is arising of nutriment, the cessation of craving, there's a cessation of nutriment. So by ceasing craving, these nutriments which cause the maintenance of you and the coming into a net you being ceases. And the way leading to the cessation of nutriment is just this Noble Eightfold Path. So that's a nutriment. Now, then we come to the Four Noble Truths. Again, core teachings. Saying, good friends, the bhikkhus delight and rejoice in the Venerable Sai Buddha's words, and they ask him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which the noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands dukkha, the origin of dukkha, cessation of dukkha, and the way leading to cessation of dukkha, and that way they're one of right view, one has arrived at this true Dhamma. And that's usually the most common description of the stream winner. They understand the Four Noble Truths fully. And of course, many of you say, I know the Four Noble Truths, but you know them fully. There's always a part of that which you haven't fully penetrated, which stops you being a stream winner. So don't take this, yeah, I know this, this makes sense. So listen carefully. What is dukkha? What's the origin of dukkha, cessation of dukkha, and the way leading to cessation of dukkha? Birth is dukkha. And just stopping at that, when I remember when I read this, I thought, God, that's really incredible. That birth is dukkha. It doesn't lead to dukkha. It doesn't cause dukkha. It is dukkha. And coming into a new life. Aging is dukkha. We all know that. Sickness is dukkha. Death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. As I said last Wednesday, not to attain what one wants is dukkha. Yampi Changna Labati Tabi Dukkha. In short, the five aggregates, the five khandhas affected by clinging are dukkha. That is called dukkha. So, the first, birth is dukkha, and also the result of birth, which is having a body, having vedana. You know, I've been trying all my life to get nice vedana and get rid of the unpleasant ones. I haven't achieved it. Have you achieved that yet? Because you can't. When you have happiness, you have to have suffering. So, as I say, the pleasantness of the senses is just a gap between the two moments of suffering, and the suffering is just a gap between the two moments of happiness. So you can't get one without the other. So the vedana is suffering and perception, having to perceive and having to will and think, and lastly being conscious is suffering. The five khandhas are suffering. And what's the origin of dukkha? It is craving, which brings renewal of being, otherwise known as rebirth or reincarnation. It is accompanied by delight and lust and delights in this and that. That is craving for the five senses, shouldn't be sensual pleasures, craving for the five senses, craving for being, and craving for non-being. This is called the origin of dukkha. The three cravings. Craving, and it's interesting there, as many commentators noticed, the craving for the pleasures of the mind, of the sixth sense, are not included there. The reason is because that is the path out. So it's, yes, leads to the end of suffering. But obviously the craving for being is still there with those, so it's still a bit of a danger. And what is the cessation of dukkha? It is a remainderless, fading away and ceasing, the giving up, relinquishing, letting go and rejecting of that same craving. This is called the cessation of suffering. Now it really doesn't make it very clear here. The giving up, that's chaga, relinquishing, patinissaka, letting go, mutti, and rejecting is analia. So those are the four ways of letting go, which don't come out, you know, when you just read it in English. You see it in Pali again and again, or you chant it, and it's very clear. And you've given many talks about that, so I won't go over here. Now, what is the way leading to cessation of dukkha is the Noble Eightfold Path. Right view up to, again, right stillness. Concentration is not the best word. When a noble disciple has thus understood dukkha, the origin of dukkha, cessation of dukkha, and the way leading to cessation of dukkha, they can now, here and now, make an end of suffering. And that way, to a noble disciple, is one of right view and the survival of this true Dhamma. So that's the dukkha. Okay, using one of your credits. Okay, yeah.
So, you know, let's say in the 12, you use three different words like abandon, abolishes, and perversion, and extirpates the undermined tendency to the you and to the I am. What's that? Third one, I thought
it is, and it's a very interesting one, because the main ignorance is actually almost giving it a definition. The main delusion is the delusion I am. And again, this is the three delusion, it's expanded elsewhere, the three conceits, I am better, I am worse, I am the same. So it's, you know, that you are anything is the conceit here. And that is the biggest delusion. I think that's it, digs it out, like roots it out, like you dig out a weed. You know, there's some weeds that jhana grow, you can't just pull them, you've got to get right underneath them to get the whole root and everything out.
So how do you extirpate that conceit? I thought that would be like...
by right view, right intention, speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness and stillness.
Okay.
Eightfold Path.
But it says here, he extirpates the underlying tendency.
Yeah. That's how you do it. It's the underlying it's the anusaya. So the reason why they say underlying tendency is that distinguishes it just from its manifestation. So it's, if you haven't got the root out, it means that maybe a year or 2 years later it might sort of still come up again. You haven't taken out the weed. Remember that for those of you who lived out in the male guest block there, you go past the Bodhi tree, and that Bodhi tree was planted just, you know, before the, a couple of years before the big fire we had, and after the fire just destroyed it because there was leaves around its base and it ring barked it. And, you know, well, Ajahn Jack and I wasn't watching, somebody came to help and said, oh, I'd better cut this tree down. So he cut down the Bodhi tree before we could stop him. So it was just a stump. So we thought, right, that's it, it's going to die. And for 3 years, it was dead. And after 3 years, it just started shooting out again. It's still alive now. So for 3 years, it was dormant. So, you know, some of these Bodhi trees are just so deep. And it's the same as the underlying tendency to conceit. It's so deep, sometimes, you know, you don't see it for 3 years. You know, you've got deep meditation. Now you think you're enlightened, and then it suddenly comes up again. So that's what we mean, that's why it's an underlying tendency. So it's extirpating, and you've got to go really deep to dig it out.
But, so what's the underlying tendency? Because if you just hear, so if you extirpate the underlying tendency to review, and to say, review, I am,
yeah.
Isn't that an underlying tendency? That review, I am,
it is an underlying tendency, but it's that particular underlying tendency. So these, it's just the underlying tendencies, it's just anything which is deeply rooted in the being out of many years of conditioning, which is different than just the... You know, somebody says, now, I've had a nice meditation, I've got no anger, I've got no conceit I have, I'm just nobody. It's very easy to have that after a nice deep meditation, after you finish a nice retreat. But you know, you don't know whether the underlying tendency, the anusaya, the thing which goes underneath everything, whether that's really been dealt with.
What's that?
Well, that is, you only know that because it's more like a karmic force. It's the fact that it comes out eventually because you haven't fully sort of taken out the delusion. There's still some part of delusion you haven't seen, still part of the Four Noble Truths you haven't penetrated. You might say the delusion is, but what do you mean by delusion? The delusion of I am, delusion that that where there's no self you think there is something there, where there's suffering you think there's some happiness, that where there's uncertainty you think there's some certainty. That's a great definition of delusion. The conceit, yes. That's right, yes. Yes, so here it is actually going for the whole works. This is, so it says the conceit I am, that's only abandoned by the arahat.
And I'm going to use up my second question. It's a short one.
Okay.
Because I was wondering why they said the kanda affected by clinging.
Okay.
Why they just say the kanda?
Okay. Okay. The word affected is something which is added there. It's Panchupadana Kanda. It means the five Upadana Kandas. Instead of clinging, my favorite word for Upadana, which comes up later, is fuel. It's another word for Upadana here. So it's, in short, the five fuels of the Kandas. And they're called fuels because they again keep driving the process. Already you've got sankhara, that's the will, that's like an ahara, that's a fuel. That's the nutriment. Consciousness is a nutriment. Now the contact, which is underlying Vedana, is a nutriment. So now they are the results, but also the causes. So that's why they're fuels. So the word affected by clinging, that is not a precise translation, because sometimes people say, oh, as long as you get rid of clinging, you still have the five khandhas. They're the five khandhas not affected by clinging. But the thing is, you can't have that. Five khandhas are the five khandhas. It says elsewhere, you can't separate. The five khandhas are the five khandhas with clinging. That's only one question. We'll let you off with that one. So having suffering, the cause of suffering is not just craving, it's also aging and death, as we see now, because, where has it got here? Okay, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. So this is the aging and death part of it. Saying, good friends, the bhikkhu is delighted and rejoicing in the venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, who's arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be friend. When friends, a noble disciple understands aging and death, the origin of aging and death, the cessation of aging and death, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death. In that way, they're one of right views, arrived at this true Dhamma. Now, what is aging and death? What is the origin, cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of aging and death? The aging of beings, in the various orders of beings, their old age, brokenness of teeth, greyness of hair, wrinkling of skill, decline of light, weakness of faculties, this is called aging. The passing of beings are the various orders of beings, their passing away, dissolution, disappearance, dying, completion of the time, dissolution of the aggregates, laying down of the body, this is called death. So those are all the synonyms, the ways which people would say of dying. These days we can say kicking the bucket. Now, what other sort of synonyms are there for dying? Sorry? Topping themselves.
Topping off.
Yeah, yes, okay. So the point here, these are just synonyms here the Buddha wanted to make sure that this is death in its normal way. And aging, the wrinkling of skin, greyness of hair, brokenness of teeth, this is really aging. So this is aging and death in its usual meaning. It doesn't mean the aging of a mind moment. It doesn't mean the death of a particular state of consciousness. It's aging and death in its normal sense. Because sometimes people take dependent origination and okay, you know, you can use it in that sense, but its main meaning is aging and death in its usual connotation. What every Joe Blow on the street would say, aging and death. And the various orders of beings, I'll go into that in the birth, because I'm going to read out from the Mahayana Sutta for that. That's aging and death. So with this aging and this death is what is called aging and death. With the arising of birth, there's the arising of aging and death. Hang on. That makes sense, because when birth arises, I'm not old yet, or dead yet. So this is needed to be pointed out. This is not a sort of a small point. In Buddhist causality, you don't have the effect immediately following the cause. When there is birth, you don't get old until many, many years have passed. So the causality in Buddhism is not just the effect follows the cause, but the effect follows the cause many years later. In the same as karma. You do some act of good karma or bad karma, you don't get instant results. Sometimes you have to wait for a long time. Just like when I ask for a cup of tea. Sometimes I have to wait a long time before it arrives. But at least I know the karma is there, the effect will soon come. So this is, with the arising of birth, there's the arising of aging and death. With the cessation of birth, there's the cessation of aging and death. And that's obvious, isn't it? Because we don't get born again, there can be no more aging and death. So with the cessation of birth, there's the cessation of death. The way into the cessation of aging and death is just this Noble Eightfold Path. So the purpose of the Noble Eightfold Path is stop you getting born again. And that's such an important point, because sometimes we forget that the whole purpose of this is to end rebirth. Sometimes in Western Buddhism that's not focused on enough, because people say, well, this reincarnation and rebirth business has got nothing to do with Buddhism. And you can have Buddhism without reincarnation. And I won't tell you the author who wrote many books about that, but you're... Sorry? Oh, see, I never mentioned it. But someone actually mentioned Stephen Batchelor's name. But it doesn't make any sense at all. It's just, it is against actually the very core teachings of the Buddha. Because without ending birth, there can be no ending of suffering. But it's not just, okay, you get a nice birth, so without any suffering. So if you get born in the right place, you can be happy ever after. That idea of like a heaven realm, which is in most other religions, is not part of Buddhism. It is seen to be essentially impossible to find any birth where you can have happiness ever after. Oh, thank you, sir. Right. Very good, making end your suffering. So, the way leading to the ending of aging and death, in other words, the way leading to the ending of birth is the Eightfold Path. So we've got, next one is birth. Saying, good friends, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sai Buddha's words, and they asked him a further question. But friends, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right views arrived at this true Dharma? There might be friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands birth, the origin of birth, the cessation of birth, and the way leading to cessation of birth, in that way they're one of right view and have arrived at this true Dharma. But I mean, what actually is birth? And why do we get born? What's the origin of birth? And is there a cessation of birth? And how do we stop being reborn? Which is the important part of this one. So what is birth, the origin, cessation, the way leading to cessation of birth? The birth of beings and of various orders of beings. They come into birth, precipitation in the womb, generation, manifestation of the aggregates, obtaining the basis of contact. This is called birth. And I am going to read from the Mahayana Sutta. How that is so, with birth as a condition of its aging and death, how that is so and how it should be understood in this way. If there were absolutely and utterly no birth of any kind anywhere, that is, of devas into the state of devas, in gandhavas, another form of lower deva, into the state of gandhavas, in yakas, into the state of yakas, in human beings, in the state of human beings, quadrupeds, in the state of quadrupeds, birds, into the state of birds, reptiles, each into the state of reptiles, each into their own state. If there were no birth of beings of any sort into any state, then in a complete absence of birth, with a cessation of birth, would aging and death be discerned? Certainly not, Venerable Sir. Therefore, Nanda, this is a cause, source, origin, and condition for aging and death, namely birth. I like to read that out because, again, it shows it's birth as people know it, into all the different types of beings which you can get reborn into. Deva realms, yaka realms, human beings, animals, quadrupeds, winged creatures, reptiles, and so on. So it's birth in its usual sense.
Would you understand that suffering, it seems like you need a very deep and thorough understanding of sensory experience of suffering?
Indeed, you do, to understand its suffering, but in here at least it's making it clear that this is how Buddhism teaches. The birth is suffering, and just having that there, and not trying to sort of make it, oh, now birth isn't suffering, it's just, you know, if you get attached to birth, or if you treat it in the wrong way, if you can let go of craving and just be, then it's no problem at all. But say that once you're born, you're in trouble. You're stuffed up again. So don't get reborn again. And again, birth. Because sometimes there was people like Jnanawira and also Buddhadasa, they started saying, oh no, birth doesn't mean birth in these states of existence, it means just birth into the moment. So every thought you're feeling, allowing this new moment to be reborn, or the birth of your sense of self with this moment. That's okay, it's a nice way of looking at things, there's nothing wrong with that, but it's not the main meaning of dependent origination as taught by the Buddha.
This is obtaining the basic contact and manifestation of the activity. That's not really, you know, birth coming out of the womb.
Ah, interesting. Is it coming out of the womb? And elsewhere, and not here, it says that the birth begins. It was mentioned in the Vinaya because there was this young prince, Kumara, who wanted to become a monk, but he was only about 19 and a half years of age when he was ordained. And he said, I wasn't fully 20. To be a bhikkhu, you have to be 20 years of age. And the Buddha said, no, I can also take the time you spent in your mother's womb, because he remembered the time in his womb as well. And he said, you can have an extra 6 months on for that, for the time in the womb. And even to this day, you know, I know in Thailand that, you know, if you're 19 years and 6 months, you can be ordained as a bhikkhu. That's counted as 20 years. They take time in the womb as well. And the reason is because the Buddha said that the human being begins when the first consciousness manifests, appears in the mother's womb. The same word, patubhavo, if those of you learning Pali or you know some Pali, in the Dhammacakka Sutta we say just as, you know, as soon as the Buddha gave the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, a great light appeared in the Deva realms. The same word is appeared, when consciousness appears in the mother's womb. So when consciousness manifests, the objects of consciousness manifest. In particular, no Vedana. That's a necessary part of being consciousness, to have the other aggregates like Vedana. That's what I say, the manifestation of the aggregates. So when does actually aggregates manifest in a mother's womb? That's when, you know, that fetus inside will react to pleasure and pain. Before that point, it's not manifest, it does not count as a human being. And I've used that argument, it's a technical argument, to say that an abortion, you know, before consciousness is manifest, before the
physical
pain, it's not a human being. according to Buddhism. Consciousness has not yet manifested in the world. Yeah.
But when does it manifest?
Yeah, they can't actually say it, the actual dates.
So it's not at conception?
Not at conception, no. In the same way, the conception, you know, the coming together of the mother and the father, when the mother sees them, that's the cause. In the same way that birth is the cause of aging and death. But aging and death hasn't happened yet. So that
cause. That's why it's called suffering, because the womb can't start feeling like suffering.
That's right, yeah.
Otherwise, it's not suffering yet.
That's right, yes. So at that time beforehand, there's a being in the womb. What is its nutriment? What keeps it going? And that has to be, you know, the mother's food, the mother's contact, will and consciousness.
Oh, and so it has to actually survive by itself if it would be, you know, ceasing.
So, yeah, indeed. So beforehand it's surviving on its mother's stuff,
yeah.
Especially its mother's will,
yeah.
And consciousness and contact. That's why, you know, the baby feels what the mother feels. You know, it actually, the baby is, you know, when it's an embryo, it is literally part of the mother. But when consciousness first manifests, the independent consciousness first manifests, that's when you can say there's a new being in there. So an abortion before that time, you know, is not killing.
The Hindus, at 7 months, they have the spirit entering
yeah.
They have a kind of observed. Like,
yeah, well, the thing is, you cannot say.
Yeah.
You don't know, but there's no, it's sometime between birth and the conception. It's interesting to know that. It makes it very interesting about abortion.
Mm-hmm.
I think most legal systems, they allow the early term abortion. I forget, you know, what time, or when it's still an embryo, but, you know, when it's a fetus. Many people object to abortions because they take ultrasounds and see this being squirming. And it's obviously, it looks like it's feeling pain. It doesn't like sort of, you know, the whatever procedure is used to abort it. And that creates a lot of revulsion in people who see that. And you can understand, you know, why, because there's a being there who can feel pain. But if the being there in the ultrasound is not feeling pain, just sitting there, the same sort of revulsion in those who can see it will not occur. Because consciousness is not manifesting in the womb. There's no obvious feeling of pleasure or pain. It's interesting, but that's actually where birth starts. Human birth. Not at the come together mother and the... That's a cause, but the cause hasn't come to fruition yet until consciousness manifests. In the same way, the birth is a cause of aging and death, but the aging hasn't come to fruition yet. Until you start to get, you know, around 40 or 50 or 60. Then you're getting old. You get some broken teeth and grey hair. I've got grey hair now. Until your eyes start to need to be operated on. Get a few broken teeth. Yeah, I think you're there. So next one is being. And this is one of the very interesting, this is Bawa. Saying, good friends. Oh, because you've got the origin of birth. That's right, I haven't gone through. That's what birth is. The birth of beings into various orders of beings. They come into birth, precipitation in the womb, generation, manifestation of the aggregates. Manifestation. It's actually they appear. Vedana appears. Obtain the basis for contact. So it's like a gynecologist will tell you the basis of contact. You actually do need the nervous system to be developed enough that there are even a physical base for contact. That's called birth. With the arising of being, this word bhava, there's arising of birth. Not contiguous, not there is a being and then birth comes later on. But this is a cause. So when there's being, later on will come birth. So I have to have the being first. The being is actually a state of being. It's like a place where the birth can happen, basically. A realm of existence. That's actually a very good definition of this word, bhava. A realm of existence, because in some places they call that the manasa bhava. You know, the realm of existence, the being of human beings. They have the deva bhava, the realm of existence of devas. They have the finished bhava, the realm of existence of finished people. A place where you can get reborn too. So this is actually interesting. Sometimes they call it like the stations of consciousness. Places where you can get reborn into. And to give another definition, I've got this in part, I have to quickly translate it for you. Because in another sutra, this is the Anguttara Threes, the Buddha was describing what bhava is. So bhava, what actually is bhava? Okay, there is karma which ripens in the karma dhatu, that's the realm of the sense, the five sense realm, like karma loka. And there is karma which ripens in the rupa loka, that's the jhana realms, and there's karma which ripens in the arupa realms, that's the triloka, the three realms where being could be reborn into. That's, you know, the, almost like the biggest classification of existence into the three worlds. And obviously there's sub-classifications, you know, in the arupa loka, the four different types of immaterial states, in the karma loka, that's in the hell realms, the ghost realms, the animal realms, the human realms, and the many deva realms. But these are the grossest classifications into the three realms. And so those are karma coming into those three realms. So karma is a field, consciousness is the seed, a craving is the moisture. So for beings who are fettered with delusion, they can get reappear, their consciousness can be established in any of these three realms. Thus, there is further rebirth. So that's now how the Buddha describes this existence. It's a process, yes, he describes how the process happens. Karma is the field, you need a degree of karma to get reborn into any of those places. And consciousness is the seed, craving is the juice, and that's how beings get reborn into any of those realms. So he said that's what actually the existence is. Those realms are the existence which you can be reborn into. So you need those realms. And this is actually, all these realms actually is what you create. You create those realms. That is why people have often asked me, and this is where that teaching comes from, why, you know, when you go to, say, a hell realm, is it just like you saw in those temple paintings in Sri Lanka or Burma or in the Tibetan tankas? Say, no, that's how they used to create those hell realms in those days. You will create those hell realms. You actually create these things. That's the whole idea of bhava. You create the being, the state of being into which you'll get reborn. So in other words, if you think, as I think these days, that the worst hell realm, the lowest hell realm, is the karaoke hell realm, where you have to suffer listening to drunken people singing out of tune for many eons. If you think you're guilty enough and deserve that, you'll send yourself down there. Yes, for your heaven realms, you can create the heaven realm you want. So in my heaven realm, you would not be listening to harp music, unless the Christians have that heaven realm. For me, it would be Jimi Hendrix on a nice in a rock group. And you won't be eating ambrosia. I never found out what ambrosia was, but in my heaven realm, it would be fish and chips with mushy peas and tea with condensed milk. So basically, you create the heaven realm. That's what the being is. It's the states of existence which you create. It's basically, bhava means existence rather than being.
If you come to work, doesn't it have an identity? Doesn't it have an identity with something that's happened in the past?
Yeah, identity with something that happens in the past. This is what you think you deserve. And it's also, this is what you think is heaven. You know, because your idea of heaven is on your own experience. So, okay, you know, if you've never listened to Jimi Hendrix before, it was maybe Adam Sumato, it would probably be Elvis Presley. Maybe if you sort of, you know, you like sort of, I don't know, what other type of music is there? disco music, probably the realm of ABBA, the ABBA heaven realm. Oh yeah, the Viking heaven. Yeah, Ajahn Bhumali used to actually tell me about Valhalla, which is like the hall of Val. That's the heaven which Vikings used to go to, and he described it to me. Now this is what they create. So the Viking, this is their existence, their heaven realm, which is not in the 32 planes of existence of Buddhism. They have their own state of existence, and their heaven realm. They, as soon as they die, they wake up, and again with a fully formed body, with all their clothes and helmet with horns, the whole works, and with their swords, and they have this big feast, and lots of alcohol. And after the feast and alcohol, they have a big fight. And they kill each other, and then they wake up again, immediately, with another feast, more alcohol, and more fighting. Because the three things which the Vikings associated with pleasure is eating, drinking and fighting. So that was their heaven realm. They made that. Because there are some people like that. They want to fight. Some people actually they go to the heaven realm of eternal sex. Because they think that's as stupid as fighting. They think that's pleasure. And some people go to the heaven realm of fish and chips and mushy peas. That's also stupid. Or kimchi. You'll get reborn in the kimchi realm, unless if you don't transcend that. But that's a serious point. This is actually the states of existence. So those heaven realms, whether it's the four great kings, or the sort of the heaven of the 33, those are created by those beings. And more have been created since. They're not fixed. Neither are hell realms fixed. Because there's many other ways of torture being developed since 25 centuries. Yeah. Yeah. Sure there is, yeah. So this is just an example. And that example can be changed. That is Adicha too. Because we build those realms. We create them, and this is the whole point here. To get birth, you have to get reborn into something. A place to get reborn, a state to get reborn into. To get reborn in a hell realm, you have to create that hell realm first. A place for you to go. It's like before you move in, you have to build your house.
Yeah.
Are you alone? What are those other beings? Are they real beings? Are they, again, your creations? Again, they're your creations. Yeah. Yeah, because, those hell realms, just like the bad dreams. Those aren't real people. That's a very complex. There are other beings in there, real beings, yes. So you're not. So it's not solipsism where you're just alone. But, we all create this realm and we all share it. It's amazing that even though we live in the same monastery, many of us live in different realms. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right, yes. So that's the state of existence we're always creating. Yeah, very deep, yeah. You create the whole world. Okay, you've got sort of the walls and the hard floor. But that's only a part of it. That's the simile I gave is when I was a kid they used to have these colouring books. They were just books like this and they had just black lines and maybe like numbers, 1, 3, 6. Number one was red and number 3 was blue or something, and you coloured it in to get a picture. And it's actually how I coloured it in, made it a beautiful picture, an ugly picture. And I say this world is like black lines on white paper. And it's how you colour it in, is the world you create. So you can't sort of do too much. You're limited by just the lines, which restrict what you can create in this world. But you can still create most of 90% of this realm you created, Luda.
So you mean that the fire could enter your mind and would be the world?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
When you see, even you tell the shape.
That's right, yeah. That's interesting, yeah, probably true. But because the way we socialise, we agree on different perceptions. That's right, so because we know, we both say light, because we've been trained that way, we've been conditioned that way. That's right, yeah, it's our social conditioning. That's right, yeah. That's right, so some people, I wonder about things like autism, where they haven't had that social conditioning. So their world is, they live in the same world, but it's totally different to ours. They create the world. Just as we do, but you know, we've learned how to create a world which we can relate with each other. Yes?
Is it all driven by what feeling a being believes it should experience?
Ah, well, this is, we find that soon, because being, where does this state of existence come from? How are they created? So understanding that gives a much better understanding of this dependent origination. Being like states of existence, that is how they're created, you know, by karma is the field, craving is the water, the moisture, which you know, need things to grow. He was using the similes of agriculture common at the time, and quite a good simile. And you know, the stream of consciousness, this thing, this process, which he called consciousness here, you know, that's the seed which gets reborn. For the stream of consciousness, and because of the craving, therefore it can grow. If you have the craving to grow in that area, yes, karma which ripens that area, that's where it will grow. And you'll create that realm, and then you get reborn into it. So you're creating these things before you're born. They're not there for you, just waiting. Not just like, you know, empty houses, you know, which you just move into. You create those houses. You build and decorate them. Yeah, you're creating them now. All your fantasies, your dreams. That's why, you know, they always say, be careful what you think about, what you want, it might come true. Okay, yes.
You said that power of solitary, is that right? It's just you and
it? Well, it appears that there may be other beings in there.
Yeah.
Oh no, you've got animal realms and animals, they learn to be in packs and in groups. Devas as well. Because look, a good example of this, they give a description of Saka's realm. He's the head of the realm of the 33. And they have his palace. And his palace has got, how many, 100 turrets, and every turret, you know, like a castle, has 100 rooms, and every room has 100 nymphs. And you know, you think that, what did those nymphs do, good karma or bad karma, to be reborn in there, having to be the sexual object of this king? Or are those nymphs just a figment, as you put it, of the king's imagination? And of course it's obvious they're the figments of the king's imagination. He creates them for his own pleasure. They're not other beings who have been reborn in there. It's the same as this idea of Yama. When people die, sometimes they had this idea that they're judged by somebody. That judge is a figment of your imagination. You're judging yourself, no one else. You create that being. So the ability to create is huge. In this realm, that ability to create has been restricted, again, by our social conditioning. People say that many kids, when they grow up, they can create these imaginary beings. You know, they're friends. I never had that. I can't speak from personal experience, but many other people say they've done that. When they were young, they had a ghost friend they used to hang out with. And for them, it's very real. They're not schizophrenic or anything. This is actually real. They can create these things. It can be. Create. You can create whatever you want. Yeah, but I mean, if it's a real psychic power, actually, you do go through those walls. Someone was telling me, they were reading, there's a book which we got, The Irreducible Mind. It's a really good read. They were talking about some of the psychic powers and some of the monks in the Middle Ages, and one got stuck in a tree. you know, high up, he was meditating, he was levitating, and got stuck in a branch, had to sort of be cut out or something. So, you know, when he was levitating, he wasn't being very mindful, and sort of got stuck in there. So, I mean, that wasn't his figment of imagination, the other monks had to cut him out afterwards. So that's what we're saying, if you do levitate in this hall, make sure it's not just rising up into there, make sure you have your landing skills as well. Taking off is easy. Ask any pilots, landing is sometimes important. But yeah, there is some creation here, but this is interesting, the Bawa. I'm glad you're getting a handle on this, because this is part of dependent origination, which was not really clear for me for many years. Okay, so let's go for it again. Say, good friends, because this is the being or the existence. Saying, good friends, the bhikkhus delight in rejoicing of venerable Sāya Buddha's word. They ask him a further question, but friend, might there be another way which a noble disciple is one of right views, or others true down, there might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands being, the origin, cessation, or where it is the cessation of being, in that way they're one of right view, and as well as true Dharma. What is this existence? The origin, the cessation, or where it is the cessation of existence. There are these three kinds of existence. The sense view of being, that's the karma loka. Again, that's, to repeat that, that's the hell realms, the animal realms, the ghost realms, the human realms, the deva realms, all the way up to the Brahma realm. They say the Brahmakayika devas, the retinue of Brahma. But Mahabrahma himself seems to straddle, you know, the first jhana realm and the highest of the karma loka. He seems to be a bit in both. And then the fine material being, which is the jhana realms. And the immaterial beings is the arupa realms. So those are the three kinds of realms of existence. With the arising of fuel, not clinging, the fuel, okay, there's the arising of these states of existence. So they need fuel, something to get them going, something to drive them, sometimes to energize them. Fuel, energy, because upadana literally means taking up. Now, like adinadana, taking what's not given, adina is not given, adana is taking. This is upadana. The adana is a taking. And upa literally means bringing it to yourself. I mean, it has very similar to up in English. So many people say upadana is actually taking up. So you can see how we get the word clinging from. You take it up means, now, I've taken up my cup, so I'm clinging to it. But also, just as like the disbulb here takes up electricity, just like the flame behind the candle takes up the oil or the wick, the candle wax. That's its fuel. That's its taking up. So that idea of clinging doesn't really sort of give the full meaning of upadana. Fuel is much better. So you can see the fuel is the cause of existence. Now where that fuel is coming from, you'll find out soon. So this is a process of fuel, which fuels it and fuels it. So if you keep on thinking really bad thoughts, you're actually fueling, you know, the construction of a hell realm, of an animal realm. So that's the fuel. I'll just finish this one, then we can ask questions. That's the fuel. Now, with the arising of the fuel, there's the arising of this state of existence. There's a cessation of the fuel. You cut off the gas. There's a cessation of these states of existence, and the way leading to the cessation of existence is this Noble Eightfold Path. That's how you cut off the fuel. When the Noble Disciple has thus understood existence, states of existence, being its origin, cessation, the way leading to its cessation, they can here and now make an end of suffering. And that way, too, a Noble Disciple is one of right views arrived at this true Dhamma. Yes.
I'm just trying to figure out how we have nutrition.
Yeah, nutrition. This is from craving, it's part of karma, but it's also you have volition. So they have the sankharas, it's also karma. That's further down the line of dependent origination.
So, well, in the beginning it's said we have food to maintain the body, just to accumulate certain things in our body.
Yes.
But this needs some condition.
Yeah, okay, that's craving. the craving or the mental volition, that is the karma. That's where the Buddha actually said, Chaitana is karma. His famous saying, Chaitanahang Karmang Vadami. That intention is the heart, the essence of karma. In other words, if you do something, you have no intention, then it's not karma. In a sense, it's connected, yeah. There's an overlap there. Different emphasis, nuance, exactly. Okay, you're over your three. That has been very good. Okay, you're going to give it to him.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. So just try and keep this small. But we're actually going well, so it's very good. So let's go to the fuel. Here, the upadana, the clinging. Paragraph 32. So, in good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sariputta's words. They asked him a further question. But, friend, might there be another way which a noble disciple is one of right view and has arrived at this true Dharma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands fuel, the origin of fuel, cessation of fuel, and the way leading to cessation of fuel, in that way they're one of right view and has arrived at this true Dharma. What is fuel? What is its origin, cessation, and way leading to its cessation? There are these four kinds of fuel. Okay, now this is the fuel which creates these states of existence, which now gives this birth and the all the rest of it. What are the four fuels? The fuel of sensual pleasures. So see, that's almost like what you're saying, the ahara of contact, in that seeking seeking delight, pleasure in the sense, five sense world. The fuel of views, that's a very good one, the wrong views, because that fuel, if you have, you know, the wrong view, that this is pleasurable, that this is important, then that fuel will create that state of existence. In other words, the state of existence of a restless mind always thinking. Of course, you know, that's what's that fuel? And the fuel is the view that that is valuable, important, that you're going to get something. The view that it's mine, my thoughts, those types of views are what will create the fuel. The clinging to rules and observances are the fuel. The rules of observances, you see why it's the fuel of rules and observances. This is thinking that these practices will get you somewhere. So, you know, learning all the chanting, doing initiations, ordinations, other particular ceremonies, like, you know, the holy water ceremony, thinking all those things of importance, they actually create. Now, they fuel a lot of all of this. And as I said the other day, that if ever you go to any Chinese monastery, you see all the people with their incense shaking it like this. And I ask people, why did you think, where did this come from, the shaking of the incense? And you know the answer to that, don't you?
The mother.
The grandmother, not the mother, the grandmother. Because they all learn it from the grandmother. And their grandmother did that because she had Parkinson's. She couldn't help herself. And because she had Parkinson's, was shaking, the little granddaughter, she thought, oh, that's how you must do it. So
my father was dead, my mother used to do this. Every time she prayed, we would put the hand over the right, and I asked her, why she did this, she's Jewish.
Yeah.
Why
they
do that? She doesn't know either
grandmother did. That's that. So anyway, that's the rules and rituals. And lastly, the fuel of an idea of a self. And of course that is the deepest one. So these are what fuels the five senses, views, rules and observances, and the idea of a self. You can see especially that last one. When you think you are, there's something there. That is the fuel which will create these places where you can manifest yourself in the future. Because this view of a self, I am, therefore I want to be the abbot of my own monastery. So you'll build your own monastery, like I stupidly did. Or you'll build, you know, where you want to go, what you want to be. So you're building those things, that's a fuel. And you can see, when it's a sense of self, you want to express that sense of self. Now, you can see that sometimes have their houses. I remember going to this community down in Denmark, south of West Australia some time ago, and had this architect, and it was very brilliant what he'd done. I said, wow, that's really beautiful. And the monk I was with said, no, that's his ego. And that was Arisila. And that was one of the wisest things he said. Because as he expressed himself, that was the fuel, and he created all these buildings. And that was him, he was expressing his sense of self. So sometimes, you know, the way we decorate our huts, you know, the fashions which we wear, that's the fuel which is creating the expression of ourself. And that's why you see these things, the view of the self is a fuel which creates these, not just huts and houses which you live in, but your future existences as well.
Maybe a pure land practice where they're viewing themselves going to going to Amitabha and all of that, they're using that, don't they?
And they're creating that realm, yes. Because sometimes they ask the Theravadas, does the pure land exist? Because it's not in the Theravada Sutras at all. They don't have that. But if people want it, they'll create it. Yeah. So they created that realm. There's like Kuan Yin exist. Many people have actually come up to me and said, no, those are honest people. Kuan Yin actually was an interesting character because it came from Avalokiteshvara, and that was going to be, like, just like, if you don't know the history, it's an interesting history to see how these things actually develop. Now, what is truth and what is creation? It started with the next Buddha, Maitreya Buddha, just like Siddhartha Gautama has two chief disciples. And the two chief disciples of Gautama the Buddha were Sariputta and Moggallana. We all know that. But do you know, it was predicted that when Maitreya Buddha becomes a Buddha, his two chief disciples will be Avalokitesvara and Wayama. Just like, you know, Ajahn Wayama, you know, who was the Dhammasara before she got sick.
Is that the
I forget what it was, where it's from, but that was actually was stated there. And that's how where it started from. And obviously, please excuse me, this was India, both were male. Now, Wayama, this was like, you know, effort, struggle. Now, that wasn't actually all that popular, because, you know, all human beings are lazy. Yeah. So that never really took off. But Avalokitesvara, the other disciple, you know, means, you know, literally the one who looks on with compassion, that was very successful. And so that actually developed and got a life all by its own, totally separated from its job as being the chief disciple of the next Buddha into being like a being which people worship by itself. And of course the earliest statues were very male, but eventually when it got taken to China it was still male in the earliest statues, but soon it was transformed into a female. Because, you know, people even today, they look upon like the mother's love as being the expression of metta, and so that feminine form eventually took over. So now Kuan Yin is one of the first of the Buddhist devas who's had the sex change, who is now female, and everyone regards him as female these days. But, and again, because many people, they worship that god, sometimes they have experiences, and many people have come up to me and they've sworn to me, they've been in trouble and they've actually seen Kuan Yin come into their room, come into their lives and help them. Are they imagining those things? You can't say that. They have created it. And don't think that that's impossible. Sorry? Yeah. It's being created.
Yeah,
come.
in these four kinds of taking up,
yeah,
driven by an attempt to capture a certain kind of feeling.
Okay, this comes out. Where did it come from? It's again from craving. So with the arising of craving, there is the arising of this fuel. You want to see Kuan Yin. Now you want her to be this way or him to be that way. The craving actually is the main force of creation.
Is it the emotional impact, like the feeling?
You can see that coming. It's the feeling, the contact, the whole works. Well, yeah, go on. He's had many questions. You can break the rules as well. Yeah, you're very good. Yeah.
And I know that you learned that with the arising of this, the correlation and the new causation, all that.
Yeah.
So, because I'm just looking at this nutriment thing, with the arising of craving, there's the arising of nutriment, and then we have the four nutriments.
Yeah.
But how do we understand, is Buddha saying causation? Because he's saying arising of this and arising of that. He's not saying it's the cause of that.
Yeah, so yeah, what he's saying is that from the cause of craving, these things will get built up. So nutriment is a very nice word because, you know, you eat food now, it takes a while to digest until all the energy gets into your body. So physical food doesn't initially sort of maintain beings, and the whole process takes time. So the same here, that the craving, obviously you see this comes up again and again, craving is enemy number one. Mm-hmm. So maybe enemy number two, you know, delusion is enemy number one. So craving comes from that. So from that craving, and it creates this fuel. You know, this is what causes the fuel to start to be generated, the fire in the fire sermon. And that sort of, that fuel creates the rebirth, but it creates the nutriments, creates the places you can be reborn, creates the being, keeps it going, and maintains the possibility of another life. This is the fuel for being seeking rebirth. And part of that, you know, the volitional, mental volition, that's also part of craving. That's another aspect of craving, because you have this mental volition, therefore you're craving. Mental volition is wider because the cravings you'll see are specific types of cravings, which we'll come on to in a minute. So you can see there's a lot of overlap here.
Could you explain how the arising of craving is the arising of the four nutriments?
Oh yeah.
Is that because the four nutriments were mental volition, consciousness, and
yeah,
something
else? Food,
the arising of craving, you get arising of food.
Okay, because if I don't want food, I won't put it in my bowl. And it will not manifest in my bowl. Yes, it does that, yeah. If I didn't have craving, I wouldn't ask the Anagarikas to cook. If I didn't have craving, Dania, the condensed milk tea and biscuits would not arise in the office at Jardin Grove in the morning when I'm giving interviews. And your craving as well. Yeah, go on, yeah. Yeah. No, that's the same thing here. It's the causality. It's like the word patio. It rests on this. This is its condition.
Oh, that's the word they use.
Yeah. Patio? Yeah, patio. Condition, cause. It comes from it. Yeah. It's this patio here. It's interesting. The patio. Mm-hmm. This is as an aside. In Thai, it's called pachai. That's now patio becomes pachai. And now in Thai, pachai is the money you give to monks. Support a cause, yeah, but that's the only way they use it these days. You know, have you got any pachai? And it just means, you know, cash. So it's interesting just how craving has actually created a new meaning of this word. Anyway, yes.
Creating all these different realms and body, not all sorts of creating like jhanas and
you can do, because sometimes people do create those, and they're not the real ones. So, because that's where they're born of letting go. So because of their cause, they're totally different. Creating these things means you do it through willpower. You want it to happen. And it's amazing what the mind can do. It can create these things. And sometimes you need a good teacher to know the difference between what is a created jhana, which is now not a real one, and what is actually the real one. And a lot of times, you come to me and say, where did it come from? What are you doing?
Also, the result is...
The result afterwards, yeah. What happens after you come out. So, there is differences there, but you can create something which is very close. That's why it's difficult as a teacher. If you give too much information, what's a jhana like? You'll be able to create it easy. Piti Sukha. So I'm going to create Piti Sukha. Okay, create Piti Sukha now. You can do it. It's not the real thing, but it's just creation. It's not coming from the right place. So that is a danger. That's why sometimes I get criticized. It's rightly because I give too much information about what the jhanas are, which means people create it, but I don't give total information. If I didn't give any information at all, you wouldn't know what you were doing, and it wouldn't work either. So it's a bit of a hard thing for me, how much information to give you.
Something very similar, I just wanted to ask if the jhanas are also created, so they're actually the cessations.
The cessations, yeah. The real jhanas are the ones which are born of letting go.
So it's the opposite direction, is that?
Yes, sir, yeah. Opposite direction. I'm creating. Because they come from non-clinging and no fuel, everything's being cut off. No craving, yes.
It says in there that craving arises.
Yeah.
Just wondering, does it ever arise or is it always there?
No, it arises because of causes. So it's not always there. There are times, everyone's day, sometimes you just got no craving, just happy sitting here, satisfied for a few moments, sometimes even longer. Everybody experiences that from time to time, but usually for most people the craving comes up pretty soon afterwards. So, that's the fuel. Now we get to craving, tanha, which also means in the Pali, thirst. It's in the Sanskrit. And knowing that other meaning for it, in just usual terms, so you have now craving, tanha. No, you can drink, come on, you're thirsty. That's its natural meaning. So, that thirst gives you an idea, you just really need something, you want something. So saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Sai Buddha's words, and they asked him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of our views of the right of this true Dharma? There might be, friends. When, friends, a noble disciple understands craving, the origin, cessation, awakening, the cessation of craving, in that way they're one of right views of the right of this true Dharma. What actually is craving? Its origin, the cessation, awakening, the cessation. Now, in this particular sutta, yeah, it doesn't sort of get deep here. It just says the six classes of craving. Craving for forms, that's seen with the eye. Craving for sounds, heard with the ear. Craving for odours, smelt with the nose. Craving for flavours, with the tongue. Craving for tangibles, felt with your body. And craving for mind objects. With the arising of Vedana, there's the arising of craving. With the cessation of Vedana, there's the cessation of craving. The way in the cessation of craving is just the Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple has thus understood craving, its origin, cessation, where it leads to cessation, they can here and now make an end of suffering, and this way to a noble disciple is one of right view. So this craving, and I've used that word, that thirst, it's a good word, the craving creates the fuel, it also creates the nutriments, the fuel creates the state of existence, giving rise to birth, old age, suffering and death and everything else. Here we all go again. So the craving is also part of the Four Noble Truths we had earlier. In the Four Noble Truths, it's not just the craving for any of the sense of the six sense objects. He says specifically for the five sense object, the karma dhanha, and the craving for existence, and also the craving to cease existence. And that too is a craving. The craving to cease existence is a craving, which is why when people try to meditate to stop the mind, they can't. That's almost like craving to not exist. You have to let go of all craving, and then things cease. You can't crave to cease. You can't do letting go. You have to let go of doing. So those are the cravings there, the dhanha. And where does that craving come from? It kind of says comes from this Vedana. And as you all know, the feeling, that idea, it's not the emotional feelings, you know, I hurt my feelings today. Doesn't mean that. It obviously means the Vedana, that aspect of every one of the six senses which is pleasurable or unpleasurable or somewhere in between. And that's why the Buddha's put in here these six senses. So craving for any of these things is what's meant by craving. And so the Vedana, the bhikkhus delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sai Buddha's words, then they asked him a further question. But friends, may there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right views of this true Dhamma? There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands Vedana, its origin, cessation, way leading to a cessation, in that way they're one of right view and this true Dhamma. And what is Vedana? Its origin, its cessation, way leading to its cessation. There are these six classes of Vedana. Vedana born of eye contact, ear contact, nose contact, tongue contact, body contact, mind contact. The six sense bases. The arising of contact, basically, for want of a better synonym, just the sense bases being turned on. With the arising of contact, there's the arising of Vedana. With the cessation of contact, there's the cessation of Vedana. The way into the cessation of Vedana is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view, right concentration. Stop there. The cessation of Vedana. All Vedana. Pleasurable Vedana, unpleasant Vedana, neutral Vedana, the whole of Vedana, ceasing. The Noble Eightfold Path leads to the cessation of all pleasure, all pain, and everything in between. So Nibbana is not this happy place where you have only pleasurable Vedanas, where you're happy ever after, just like riding off into the sunset with your spiritual love, where you'll love her or him for eternity and be happy ever after. There is no ever after. Buddhism is not Disney. So this is a cessation of Vedana. Now that's a powerful teaching there. Are you ready for that? No Vedana at all. No pleasure, no pain, not even in between. Everything gone. Now get your head around that. You understand a bit about what Nibbana is and cessation is. Because so many people think, oh, Nibbana, this happy place, just like a heaven, but you know, just much better than those stupid Christian heavens. This is Buddhist heaven. We're much better than they are. Our pleasures are more, you know, refined. But no, it's all Vedana. Stop. Cease. Gone. Finish. Kaput. Nothing there. Get that?
Bliss.
Yeah, it's bliss. There's nothing left.
There's no bliss left.
No, bliss is gone. Totally gone. Finish. Kaput. How can there be bliss when there's nothing to feel? Now it gets even more. Stop it. It gets even more interesting in a few minutes. But it's getting that point here that I'm just emphasizing. Sometimes people pass this over because they're in denial. But this is what it's saying. No, that was the explanation of Sariputta. This was Uddaya Narsis. It was in the Sangyutta somewhere. When he said, how on earth can you call Nibbana the highest happiness when there's nothing left there? There's not even any feeling. Feeling has ceased. How can you call it the highest happiness or bliss? And Sariputta's answer was this, and he used a simile, just like when you're sick. When you get healthy again, is that happiness? Of course it's happiness. Why? Because an affliction has ended. Sickness has ended. Yeah, because an affliction has ended. When on Monday evening, tomorrow, No, 2 more days when I go on retreat. It's bliss. Because an affliction has ended. I don't have to see anybody or answer any more questions. I'm free. Yeah, so this is affliction has ended. So because the Buddha was saying, vedana is an affliction. It's an irritation. And a few of us have been talking about that simile, which is, I think it's in the Canto saying to somewhere, of the flayed cow. This cow who's had its skin taken off, but still alive. That's torture enough. To have all these flies landing on it. Now, and if you've had like one mosquito landing on you, imagine like flies landing on sensitive skin. So that's what vedana is like. Now that's really negative. But you know, once you have some of the vedana ceasing, you might say, actually that's what it's like, it's this great irritation. I've got to scratch this, I've got to go to the toilet, I've got to do this, I've got to ache here, vedana, I've got to see, I've got to speak, I've got to hear. Gee. So to see it's an irritation here is because it's dukkha, it's ceasing is bliss. That's what the Buddha meant by nibbana is bliss. Yes, Kapil. Yes. Okay. Is that happy? Very good. That's good. See? The ending of suffering will come to you in a few seconds. That's the trouble. You talk about sort of toilet and then you want to go. Yes, see? Aha. Aha, that's a microphone. Yes. Were they real? Or did he create them? So that's the answer. Just like in the hell realms, you create the torturers. In the Sakha, in the Deva realm, he creates, somebody worked it out, 580,000 nymphs or something. You can actually multiply these, and I forget who actually multiplied them, but in that sin here somewhere, I think in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sakha describing all his pleasures. And you know, there were so many nymphs, there's hundreds of thousands of them there. And that must be terrible. If they were devas in the deva realm, they'd have a terrible time, you know, having to deal with this mandy old Sakha. I shouldn't say things like that, but you can understand what we're talking about. So that's suffering for them. So what they're doing in the heaven realm, that's, you know, maybe Sakha is in heaven, but that's a hell realm for them. So was it a hell realm or a heaven realm? Was in that? Obviously they weren't real beings, he created them. So this is what happens, this is, you know, what we do. So that was the way the mind created those beings, you know, as a way of perceiving the attainment of enlightenment. So I'd imagine that sort of, now, I don't know for sure, because I wasn't there, never heard this from Ajahn Mun, because I never met Ajahn Mun. I imagine that he would actually say that this is what the nimitta I had would never be meant to be interpreted as real arahats coming, but just, you know, the vision which arose. He would understand that that was the creation of his mind, not real. Because if they were real, it's totally inconsistent with all these teachings which you read in here. Yeah?
So basically it means that our life, our human existence, all what we do, what we get experience, food, pleasure, whatever, that's something that we create in the past, probably.
Correct, yeah. Yes, so you very much created this. Don't blame anybody, it's karma. You created it.
So, when we sit in here and share in this world,
yes.
We did something in the past?
Together, yes. Yeah, we did some sort of karma which got us here together again. That sucks, doesn't it? Let's make this the last time, okay, Danny? Yeah, that's right. Remember, you can't complain to anybody. It's not someone else's fault. It's your fault. Go on, Daniel. What's this? Is it 7 or 8? No, go. Go on. Okay. To see, yeah. Yes, yeah.
Okay, letting go, but then a pleasure arises
and then let go, and another pleasure arises. Yeah. So it's kind of like a carriage. Yeah. Arising, nothing arises anymore. So it's kind of like you infer it's left. Correct, yeah. Everything is ceased. So, because once you know that, and really understand that, say, feeling is suffering, and get deeper into this in a few moments, you realize, well, the cessation of this is an affliction, it's an illness. That's why somebody once said, and it's a very nice saying, it's not in the suttas, the meaning of life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Which is very good. Good, isn't it? Anyway, let's get back to... I wish I'd have said that, but... Contact. Saying, good friends, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sai Buddha's words. Then they asked him a further question. But friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right views and right this true Dharma? There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands contact, the origin of contact, cessation, where it is cessation of contact, then they are one of right view, one is a right this true Dharma. What is this contact, this pasa? What is its origin, its cessation, where it is cessation? There are these six kinds of classes of contact. Eye contact, eye contact, ear, nose, tongue, body contact, mind contact, the arising of the sixfold base, the six senses, you need like the eye base. The eye is not the physical eye, there's actually a good different word for that in Pali, but it's a whole sensory apparatus. Now the orb of the eye, the optic nerve, the part of the brain which can process all of this, and that is the eye base.
Good translation is the sensitive base.
Yeah. The ear sense space, the nose sense space, tongue, body sense space, the mind sense space, whatever that is. You find it out when you meditate. With the arising of the sixfold base is the arising of contact, the cessation of the sixfold base is the cessation of contact. The way it is the cessation of contact is this noble eightfold path. The noble disciple has also understood contact, its origin, cessation, the way it into its cessation, he there now makes an end of suffering. And that way to a noble disciple is one of our views of right of his true Dhamma. Just as a sixfold base, before we go further, saying, good friends, the monks delight and rejoice in the venerable Sariputta's words. Then they asked him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of my views of either this true Dhamma? There might be, friend. When a noble disciple understands the sixfold base, its origin, cessation, and way in this cessation of sixfold base, in that way, well, they are one of my views of either this true Dhamma. What is the sixfold base? What's its origin, its cessation, and the way it is the cessation of the sixfold base? There are these six bases, the eye base, the ear base, nose base, tongue base, body base, and mind base. With the rising of nama-rupa, mentality, materiality, there's the rising of the sixfold sense base. With the cessation of mentality, materiality, nama-rupa, there's the cessation of the sixfold base. Hang on. That's the cessation of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. Cessation of mind base as well. So it's not just the mind continuing on, some mind which continues on, it's a cessation of all the six sense bases, including the citta, the mind base. The way it is the cessation of the sixfold base is just this noble eightfold path, that is right view, right concentration. So if you practice the noble eightfold path, you lose your mind. Well, it wasn't yours anyway, so you haven't lost anything. When a noble disciple has outside understood the sixfold base, its origin, cessation, where it is cessation, they can now here and they now in this life make an end of suffering. In that way, to a noble disciple is one of my views about this true Dhamma. Now, Nama-rupa, this particular one got really messed up by the Abhidhamma. there's Nama Rupa here, really clear. Nama Rupa in the Abhidharma is totally different. So I'm just Nama Rupa in here. And this is one of the problems here, because a lot of sometimes teachers, they have Nama Rupa, it's explanation from the Abhidharma. This is Nama Rupa of the suttas, and it is different. Saying, good friends are much delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Disciple with his words. Then they ask him a further question, but friends, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of our views of this true Dhamma? There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands Nama Rupa, its origin, cessation, and the way in the cessation of Nama Rupa. In that way, they are one of right views of right and this true Dhamma. What is Nama Rupa? What's its origin, cessation, and the way it ends its cessation? Feeling, that's Vedana. Perception, that's Sanya. Volition, that's Chetana. Contact and attention, that's Manasikara. These are called Nama. This is Sariputta accepted at the First Council as the meaning of Nama. So it does not include consciousness. It's one of the great differences of Nama in the Abhidharma. It includes consciousness. Here it does not. So there's the three khandhas there, Vedana khandha, Sanya khandha, volition, that's the main part of the Sankhara khandha, the fourth khandha. And contact, manasikara, that's also part of the fourth khanda. Those are called nama. Rupa is the four great elements and the material form derived from the four great elements. These are called materiality. That's stuff. So this mentality and materiality together are called mentality and materiality. With the arising of vijnana, consciousness, is the arising of these other four khandas. The cessation of consciousness is the cessation of these four khandhas, Nama Rupa. The way to the cessation of Nama Rupa is just this Noble Eightfold Path. So again, Nama Rupa and consciousness can see just how they do cause each other. And this is not any time lag. It's called like the two sheaves of reeds in the Sanyutta Nikaya. You have Nama Rupa and Vijnana, consciousness, and the other four aggregates, four khandhas. When one of them goes, the other one falls off, over, cannot exist. So without consciousness, there cannot be Nama Rupa. Without consciousness, there cannot be Vedana, Sanya, Chetana, contact and attention. There cannot be any of those things without consciousness. Without those things, there can't be consciousness. They come together. So that's brilliant, because if you're conscious, if you know, you have to have Vedana. And Vedana is not just always one thing, it has to be pleasant and unpleasant. To be conscious, to know what we say to exist, is to suffer. Sometimes pleasure, sometimes pain, but we cannot get total pleasure. Impossible. Because we are conscious, we will have perception. Because we're conscious, we will have volition. You can let go of the doer for a time, it will come up again afterwards. You will never destroy volition. You never be able to let go totally until you cease. So what's happening here is you're letting go a lot, long enough to stop. That's why the Buddha had volition. But his volition wasn't coming from defilements, it was a volition for the happiness and benefit of all sentient beings. If the Buddha had no volition at all, I often used to joke, if an arahat had no volition, no desire left, they would never even, like Kartal, decide to go to the toilet. They would just drop their bundle right here. To get to the toilet, you needed volition. And the Buddha never did that. He used toilets. So even arahats have volition because they have consciousness. Yes.
Is that what happens to
the Pratyeka Buddhas? The Pratyeka Buddhas, the volition, this is another point here, the volition to teach. The volition to teach. After you become enlightened, you can imagine a Buddha becoming enlightened. You imagine when you've got deep meditation. You just come out of a deep meditation. Do you want to do anything? Now, you may have not even got jhanas yet, but you go a nice meditation, you just want to sit here. Oh, this is so nice. You don't even want to do anything. You don't want to sort of go and sort of make the breakfast or, you know, even go and eat sometimes. You don't want to sit here, it's just so nice. I can imagine that multiplied, you know, Buddha just coming out from under the Bodhi tree enlightened. So, totally in mind, so still and active. And he would have inclined to inaction. In other words, wouldn't have done anything. He would not be able to have the karmic causes to create that volition to do anything if it wasn't for Brahma Sahampati. Asking the Buddha, please teach. And if you've had any deep meditations, understanding how this whole process works, you realize that was a very crucial part in the origin of Buddhism. Yeah, the Buddha taught the Dhammacakka, but teaching the Dhammacakka wasn't really the starting of the wheel. The wheel was really started when Brahma Sahampati asked the Buddha to teach. That was the real origin. And if Brahma Sahampati hadn't done that, Siddhartha Gautama would have been a Pratyeka Buddha. So I often mention that because that was, you know, Brahma Sahampati was a god. I often say, thank God for Buddhism.
The Buddha didn't create him.
Sorry?
Buddha didn't create him.
Oh no, that was a real being. That's a tough question. You're very sharp. Okay, so we get to consciousness, paragraph 56. Saying, good friend, the monks delighted and rejoiced in the venerable Sai Buddha's words, and they asked him a further question, but friends, might there be another way in which the noble disciples want to arrive views of art of this true Dharma, there might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands vijnana, the origin of vijnana, the cessation of vijnana, and the way it leads to the cessation of consciousness. In that way, it's one of the right views of this true mind, true Dhamma. And what is consciousness, mind, knowing? What is its origin, cessation, and the way it leads to cessation? There are these six classes of consciousness, or we may say six totally different types of consciousness. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. And I've mentioned before this, fruit salad simile, and it's because one moment of consciousness is followed by another moment of consciousness, especially by mind consciousness. So you see, the mind knows you see. You hear, the mind knows you've heard. You know, you touch something, the mind knows you've touched something, or you've known, and then you know you've just known. Because the mind consciousness follows after every perceived conscious experience, it is the interference of the mind consciousness which gives the illusion of the continuity, as if consciousness is just this smooth flow which always is the same. So when you see, seeing something, what does it have in common with hearing something? Hearing, what's that in common with tasting or touching something? What is in common to all these different classes of consciousness, which gives the illusion that it is a continual process? And you see, what's actually happened is this mind consciousness that creates the illusion. It always carries on one after the other. So actually, when you see, you don't just see. You have the seeing consciousness followed by mind consciousness. You see, then you know you saw. See, you hear, then you know you've heard. And it's that immediately followed by the knowing which creates this illusion that there's all the same. And that creates the illusion, well, that must be me. The thing which was there, seen a moment ago, heard what I said a few moments ago. That continuity, break through that and you've seen, aha, that's where I got lost, thinking this person who saw a moment ago is the same as the person who's hearing right now. it's illusion. But once you see this fragmentary consciousness, one following after the other, and you know the difference between mind consciousness and seeing consciousness, then as you see, and then close. You knew you see, so. Knowing this experience. So you figure it out. Yeah. See? Oh, Angi, you don't know, that came after the time of the Buddha. Never mentioned that word, never in the suttas. The Buddha gave the example of the Simsapa leaves. Once he took up some leaves in his hands, and he said to the monks, the nuns, the lay people, which is more, the leaves in my hand, or the leaves in this whole forest? They said, the leaves. They didn't say that's a stupid question. Everyone was very respectful to the Buddha. They say, the leaves of the forest are much more than the leaves in your hand. He said, similarly, what I've taught you is like the leaves in my hand compared to what I know. But the reason why I haven't taught anything else is because that has got nothing to do with the Dharma and with the path to enlightenment. So what I've taught you is all you need to know. I often follow that. Because that means if it's not in the suttas here, it wasn't really taught by the Buddha, it's unnecessary, superfluous. So the Bhavanga is something, a concept which came after the time of the Buddha. I don't even like to even just to add that framework. Yeah, that's why I never actually used that or explored it. I've deliberately avoided it. Simply because as soon as I found out it wasn't part of the Buddha's teachings, and as soon as I saw that, I said, look, let's just focus on what the Buddha taught. And all these other concepts, however they were, don't really have any purpose. They're not part of the Simsapa leaves which the Buddha had in his hand. So they're superfluous. Irrelevant. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Okay. It is in the jhanas, there is a result of some volition there. So it is like the echo of volition. I gave a simile, I remember I gave this to Bhante Ji some years ago. It's like the archer. The archer has actually shot the arrow. As the arrow is moving towards the target, there's no more volition, it's shot. But it carries the volition, almost like karma, until it hits the target. So it's a letting go, which was created as a type of volition. The letting go which you created. As the arrow has been shot, that you enter the first jhana, you can't stop it. You can't change. As soon as you get into the jhana realms, you can't do anything. But the volition, the skill or the speed, the strength which you shot the arrow of letting go, that is what drives you from the first to the second, maybe to the third, maybe to the arupas. Just like you shoot an arrow, it carries the aim of the archer. But it hasn't reached the target yet. It's a nice stimuli. Volition is not there, but the effect of volition is there.
Volition is like an action or letting go is a letting go action.
That's right, but that's a volition to stop. The effort to say no, the effort to renounce. Which qualifies as a volition. Okay. So, with your eyes, okay. That's the touch of consciousness. Where does consciousness come from? Now, here, in another sutta, Mahanidana, it says that with the arising of Namarupa, there's the arising of consciousness. And it says that's where it turns around. So that's in Mahanidana Sutta. But here, it goes to another trail. So with the arising of formations or sankharas, there's the arising of vijnana. The cessation of sankhara is the cessation of consciousness. The way in the cessation of consciousness is just this Noble Eightfold Path, that is right view to right stillness. So again, the Noble Eightfold Path leads the cessation of consciousness. Not just the five kind of consciousness, but mind consciousness as well. But to make this quite clear, we go to the sankharas, and so we actually can see this is where the karma comes in. So in good friends, the bhikkhus delight and rejoice in the venerable disciple who just wears. Then he asks him a further question, but friend, may there be another way, which a noble disciple is one of right views of either this true dharma, there might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands sankharas, the origin of sankharas, the cessation of sankharas, and the way leading the cessation of sankharas, in that way they are one of right views of either this true dharma. And what are the sankharas? What's their origin, cessation, way leading to cessation? There are these three kinds of sankharas. Kaya sankhara, body sankharas, verbal sankharas, and mental sankharas. So you see, this is the use of the word sankhara in a very different way to the sankharas in the five khandhas. So sankharas, some words, they have more than one meaning, depending in their context. So that's why, you know, you have other words, you know, have, you know, more than one meaning. Let's think of, you know, nice words that have more than one meaning. You can see, like in the dictionary, a meaning one, meaning two, meaning three, meaning four. So, these sankharas, you can see here, the bodily, verbal, mental formations, that's karma. And very often that's actually said, this is what the karma, body karma, verbal, speech karma, or mind karma. So this is actually where the karma comes in, the karma causing the consciousness. In the same way as karma is a field, vijnana is the seed. This is what they, without the field there cannot be no seed, without the seed no field. So with the rising of delusion, instead of ignorance, is the rising of these karma formations. With the cessation of delusion is the cessation of karma formations. The way leading to the cessation of karma formations is just the Noble Eightfold Path. When a noble disciple thus understands karma formations, its origin, cessation, the way leading to the cessation, they can, in this life, make an end of suffering. And the right way to a noble disciple is one of right view. So these are karma formations, and of course they're caused by delusion. So these are particular karma formations which give rise to consciousness. So with the cessation of these karma formations, there is a cessation of consciousness. So as soon as you cease making karma, you become unconscious. Right? That's what it says here. With the cessation of formations, there's a cessation of consciousness.
Cessation of karma.
Yeah, well, the cessation of karma, there's a cessation of consciousness.
Karma making that.
It says in number 50, with the cessation of formations, there's a cessation of consciousness. So what does that mean? You stop making karma formations, does that mean you... Remember cause and effect. Some of these causes mean the effect happens exactly the same time, sometimes a moment later, sometimes a long time afterwards, like birth. Cessation of birth. So with birth as a condition, there is the arising of aging and death, which is a long time afterwards, sometimes 30, 40 years, 50 years before you die. So the cessation of karma formations... Now through the cessation of delusion, what sort of consciousness ceases? Yes, thank you so much. I was fishing for that for a long time. So here it's obvious it must mean the consciousness in your future life, the rebirth consciousness. Here, commentaries, Abhidharma, well done. You got it right. So I don't always argue with these things. Because it's logical, because when delusion finishes, you see that delusion causes these sankharas. When is delusion overcome, once and for all, forever? When you become an when you become an arahat. They say that's the cessation of delusions. Kamitsun, it's knowing the Four Noble Truths. Then delusion is finished, overcome, not arise again. So that means when delusion is finished, the arrival of the attainment of arahat, then the karma formations stop and consciousness stops. So it can only mean the consciousness, the first consciousness in your next life. Because an arahat is certainly conscious. The Buddha was conscious, Sariputta was conscious. So the cause and effect, to understand that properly, you see, sometimes the causes and the effects are contiguous. Like, I never mentioned here, like consciousness, six bases, contact, Vedana, that's all together, happening in the same moment. You can't have one with the other, like consciousness and Nama Rupa. Consciousness causes Nama Rupa, Nama Rupa causes consciousness. That's the same moment. You can't have one without the other. It's not like consciousness arises and then Nama Rupa, or Nama Rupa arises and then is consciousness. They arrive at the same time. But here, the karma formations and consciousness are time-lapse. So those are the three types of formations: the arising of delusion, arising of karma formation, cessation of delusion, cessation of karma formations. When in cessation of karma formations, Noble Eightfold Path. When Noble Disciples thus understood karma formations, its origin, cessation, the way it is the cessation, they can in this life make an end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right views, arising this true Dhamma. Yes, sir, you had a question, someone? Yeah, go on.
Does a noble disciple have every one of these right views?
A noble disciple has every one of these right views. No, not at the same time. So, any one of the right views will do. Different aspects of the same thing.
Does that just depend on conditioning, which one?
Yeah, in the sense they have the right view as the underlying right view. So it's always there for them if they want to access it.
So they understand characteristics, but it's manifest in different ways according to like
anger. Indeed, yes. And delusion, saying, good friend, the monk's delight in rejoicing the venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question, but friend, might there be another way which a noble disciple is one of right views, arrive at this true Dhamma? There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands delusion, not ignorance, like avijja is delusion. The origin of delusion, the cessation of delusion, the way it is the cessation of delusion. That way they're one of right view, one has arrived at this true Dhamma. And that's obvious, that delusion is the enemy number one, I say. Once you got rid of delusion, then you have right view. What is delusion? Its origin, cessation, where it leads to the cessation of delusion. In this particular aspect, not knowing about dukkha, not knowing about the origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and the way it leads to the cessation of dukkha. This is called delusion. And here they have, like, with the arising of these asavas, these outflowings, this is the arising of delusion. With the cessation of the asavas, this is the cessation of delusion. The way it leads to the cessation of delusion is this Noble Eightfold Path. The noble disciples thus understood delusion, its origin, cessation, where it enters the cessation, they can here and now make the end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right views of this true Dhamma. The outflowing, the asavas, saying, good friend, the monk's delight in rejoicing the venerable Sariputta's words, they ask him a further question, but friend, might there be another way in which a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, has arrived at this true Dhamma? There might be friends. When friends, a noble disciple understands these outflowings, the origin, the cessation, the way leading to the cessation. In that way, they are one of right view, whose view is straight, whose unwavering confidence in Dhamma is arrived at true Dhamma. And what are these outflowings, the origin, the cessation, the way leading to the cessation? There are these three outflowings. The outflowing from sensory desire, the five senses. You go out into the world to enjoy the five senses. The outflowing of being, just to be. You go out there to show you exist. The outflowing of delusion. You do it because you don't know what you're up to. With the arising of delusion, there's the arising of the asavas. With the cessation of delusion, the cessation of the asavas. The way in the cessation of the asavas is just this Noble Eightfold Path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, action, livelihood, effort, mindfulness, and stillness. So you see that here in this definition of the dependent origination, from delusion is caused by the asavas. The asavas are caused by delusion. So say this is where they run around. I like this because when you go out into the world to play, you are causing delusion to grow. That's why when you keep the asavas inside, you don't go out, you go in, which is what we do here, seclusion, keeping the mindfulness inside, not going into the future or the past, not going off into seeing things, reading things, doing things, but keeping inside. Just like the Hindu idea of the tortoise putting all its limbs inside, drawing in instead of going out, then there you are stopping the asavas, reducing delusion, and thereby you're stopping the whole process by stopping the outflowings. And of course, why do you stop the outflowings? Because of the delusion that they belong to you, it's something important. So when a noble disciple has thus understood the outflowings, the origin of the outflowings, the cessation of the outflowings, the way it leads to the cessation of the outflowings, they entirely abandon the underlying tendency to lust. It's not just lust, it's any type of sensory desire. Underlying tendency to aversion, extirpates, digs out, like digging out the weeds, the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning delusion, arousing true knowledge, they in this very life make an end of suffering. In that way too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, has an unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. So there, right view, noble eightfold path, four noble truths, dependent origination. Elsewhere the Buddha said, the one who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. The one who sees Dhamma sees dependent origination. Because that's a key teaching, cause and effect, and how this whole process of rebirth happens. Now, how we create our worlds, how we make rebirth and more suffering for ourselves. That is what the Venerable Sariputta said. The monks, the nuns, the lay people, devas as well, I imagine, were satisfied and delighted in the Venerable Sariputta's words. That's a big sutta. Yes, Brendan.
When you say the tank of sensual desire, does it include, the mindset?
Sorry, the mind, it does not, no.
So, what's the outpouring to, where does that include the outpouring to enjoy?
Now, it's fascinating why it's not included in there, because the mindset is like an inflowing. So, you know, the mind, in a sense, inside, it goes out to play in the world, the five senses. When you go in, that's when you access the mind. So, in a sense, it's not really an outflowing, and it's not, say, included in the cravings, simply because it's not the craving which leads to rebirth. You know, but indulging in the pleasures of the mind, in the jhanas, is a way to end rebirth. It's the Panchala Chandana Sutta. That's the one which I mentioned recently. It's in the Bhikkhuni Sangyutta. That's where this deva came to say, oh, the Buddha who discovered the jhanas. So when people say, oh, the Buddha discovered vipassana, it never says that anywhere, but it does say the Buddha discovered jhanas. And that's repeated by Ananda after the Buddha passed away. When there are, you know, Ananda was the go-to person for the Dhamma because he'd been around the Buddha such a long time and associated with the Buddha. And they were asking, how do you get out of samsara? And he said, what did this deva mean by the Buddha discovered jhanas? He said, he discovered this is the way out of samsara. Just like a hole in a wall is a way to get out of the room. He said, it's the first jhana is a way to get out of the five sense world. The second jhana is how to get out of the first jhana. Third jhana is how to get out of the hole to get out of the second jhana, and so on. And that was actually Ananda's beautiful take on that. So that's why, because those jhanas are a way out, they're not really the craving which creates more rebirth. They do create rebirth, but in another sense, they're part of the way out. As far as the cravings are concerned, you can legitimately put them in the craving of being. Because in a sense, you exist, this beautiful high self exists in there, but most of existence is gone. Does that make sense? Any other question? Yes, Buddha. Pretty much the same word, but moha is just more coarse, more gross. You're just an already deluded person. You know, it's more like stupidity, moha. So you know, you say that a person is too stupid to tie up their own bootlaces. That's moha. Or they're so stupid that they leave the rice cooker on and burn the rice. They can't even just make the porridge in the morning properly. Whatever it is, and that type of stupidity, it's a beautiful point, I'm not criticising anybody, but that is a moha. But the avijja is just a more deeper understanding of, of deeper misunderstanding of a sense of self. So moha is more general, avijja is pretty specific to the cause of suffering. Yes, Chiwei? Not necessarily. If they experience a cessation of all, they can experience the cessation of the five sense consciousnesses in the jhanas. So there, five of the six consciousnesses ceased. So at least they understand the cessation of five consciousnesses, but they've still got the mind consciousness. They can infer from that experience the cessation of the sixth consciousness, the mind itself. Just like these five ones are finished, they can now know that the sixth one is also subject to cessation. They can experience the cessation of all the six consciousnesses only if they attain that Nirodha Samapatti in this life, which means it's said that if they come out afterwards, they're an anagami or an arahat. There's only two choices. And they're an anagami if they delight in that experience and find the sense of being there. It is the craving to be which stops the anagami being the arahat. That is their sense of existence. So they get reborn in the anagami realm, creating that realm. That's where they live until they let go of that last craving to be. But the cessation of consciousness, temporarily, yes, Nirodha Samapatti, all jhanas, cessation of five consciousnesses, and the sixth consciousness beginning to cease, you can see it fading away. Full cessation of consciousness without remainder, once and for all, is Parinibbana. Does that answer the question? Yes. Yeah. Okay. The view of self being abandoned by the stream winner, but just the old habits through thinking and perception can still arise. Basically, the old habits, even though you know it's wrong, you know it can't be true, forgetfulness. That's right. That's also one of the reasons why they say only the arahat has perfect continual mindfulness. Not in the mindfulness in the sense of always being aware, but the mindfulness in the sense of always knowing the Dhamma. So that arahat will not ever forget there's no self. A good example of that is poor Ananda. He was a stream winner, an Arya, but when he heard the Buddha was going to die, he just went off and cried. And he said the Dhamma just disappeared for him at that time. He just basically, we say, went out the window. He lost his mindfulness, he forgot. Basically, that all things are impermanent. Even the Buddha's going to die. Even though he's a stream winner, then it's a great description of a stream winner. A stream winner, yes, you know, but you forget, and old habits are just so strong. Yes? Yeah.
I was just wondering, why did the Buddha, what does he want us to understand from the taint which resident seems to get ignorant and not having the framework of hindrances.
Well, hindrances is another framework which explains the origin of the of delusion. But you look at the hindrances, like the first two hindrances, you know, like desire and ill will. They're outgoings of the mind. The first one is very much like the karma. The outflowing of sensual desire. And no, with desire there will always be ill will as well. It's desire not to have this. So, you know, that is also the second hindrance. And obviously when you go out, you're being restless. You don't want to stay at home. That's what restlessness is. You don't want to stay here. And sloth and torpor is the result of all of that going out. You get tired. Every time I go out, tomorrow going out to the nuns' monastery, to even just going out from this monastery tires me out, gives me sloth and torpor. So you can see how the mind going out with his asvas. And sometimes when you go out to the nuns, well, I don't know, I know the nuns mostly, sometimes when I go out somewhere else I get lost. So doubt. You don't know the way back home. That's doubt. When you're at home you know the way back. So delusion is like one of these Alzheimer's people. You sort of forget, where do I live? Okay, Martin?
All that's just been described, it's really complicated. I base a whole life.
Yeah. Well, it's just how the Buddha actually probably discovered this is just by observing. Because remember, how it come to being in the first place, the origin of these things. Yeah, but the Buddha actually did mention in one of the suttas. It's actually, if you read this book, the Middle Leg Sayings, it's just abbreviated. It actually just says, look at the Sutta Nipata, where it also exists. There it says that some, even plants, even that type of being, has a rudimentary form of vijnana. And it's as if it's saying that can evolve into like, from a plant, to an animal, and of course you all know if you've done your biology there are some forms of existence which are on the edge between plant life and animal life. Even sometimes you can't say what it is. So you can see how an evolution can take place. Now how beings can use those bhavas, those states of existence, to develop their stream of consciousness. Yeah, many lifetimes.
So what was driving that? What drives
craving. Drives it. Because you want, therefore craving you get. Sorry?
Craving existed before.
Craving existed before. No, delusion and craving go together. So when is craving, there's delusion. When is delusion, there's craving. So that they support each other. So exactly what the idea of an origin is pretty much like endless. You want to find the first cause, then what created the first cause. And I think it was actually in Hawking's books, The Brief History of Time, he was actually posing the idea of an origin, of a start and an end. It just shows a narrowness of perception, and the alternative is, or the way to understand this is using some physics. The universe in which we live in, it's a certain space. It's actually confined. The volume of this universe is pretty much worked out. It's a finite volume. It's got no edges to it. A finite volume with no boundaries. And at first you say, that doesn't make sense. If it's a finite body, they must have what's inside and what's outside. But the answer is the simile of the ants on the football, and the soccer ball. So the ants, the soccer ball, goes round and round and round trying to find the end of the universe. It goes round and round, never finds it. Because even the soccer ball, the area of the soccer ball is a finite area. There's got no end to it, no boundary. Because it's curved in another dimension. That was Einstein's great theory. So because the universe is curved, it has no boundaries, but it has got a finite volume. So Hawking was suggesting perhaps the same with time. No beginning, no end, but a finite duration. Is it bending your mind? Exactly what it's supposed to do. That's the only thing which is logical.
I
know. Yeah, go
on. Just one comment. It's a very, to follow what you just said.
Yeah.
It's a very amazing thing. That's why all our mental desires to understand anything in the machine. It's so free. But there's something there that we can learn. And I think Daniel mentioned it a few times. And we've skirted around it a few times and played around with it a few times. The ahara and the fuel.
Yes.
Those two, that two metaphors, they're just metaphors.
Yeah.
The whole, everything in the whole sutta, they're just ideas, thoughts that our mind likes to play with, and we play very well with them, and it satisfies every desire that the mind could have about the Buddhist teaching, and on any kind of level you can go to. You know, it's very good. Sarapun is very good at this. But the two, the metaphors of the ahara and the upadana, those two are very powerful because they teach us something. If we go and look very carefully, what did they teach us? That there is a fuel and we can stop the fuel. That's the teaching. Because otherwise the sutra is very confusing. But actually it gives us hope because, yeah, there is a fuel for everything.
Yep.
If we know what the fuel is, we can stop that. And how do you stop it? The big one is self.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, you then lead her up. Yeah, John. Go on. Yeah.
Is that based on the experience of the consciousness of the five senses of vanishing?
Yes, the inference that if you are in the jhana and you come out afterwards, you realize that this five consciousness has ceased. Remember the simile of the tadpole and the frog? Tadpole doesn't know what water is, but once tadpole becomes frog, they knew what water was. So these things called the five consciousnesses. Now it sees them cease. Now it can know what mind consciousness is. So once it knows what mind consciousness is, what happens when this other five consciousness vanishes, then it can actually just see, just even outside, that mind consciousness is vanishing all the time. Because now you've got sight consciousness, and when you've got sight consciousness, there's no mind consciousness. And then mind consciousness arises. And it breaks the idea of continuity. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, that can happen. Because, you know, you've actually sussed out the trick. You can see the consciousness is fragmentary. Because you can actually know, when you know what mind consciousness is, you can separate mind consciousness from the other consciousnesses, which most people just cannot do. Then you actually know that it's a fruit salad. There's an apple here. The apple disappears. And there's a coconut. Apple, eye consciousness, coconut, mind consciousness, that's in my fruit summary. So you see there's an apple here, and it's totally disappeared. Wow, it's gone, and it's replaced by a coconut. And then the coconut disappears. And then it's a banana, that's nose consciousness, because I've got banana nose. And so you can see this play of momentary consciousnesses. Because you now know what mind consciousness is, you can separate it. And you see not only the five senses come and go, but also mind consciousness come and go.
Is that from the power of the jhana applied to
just like, yeah, from the data which you gain from the jhana experiences. The frog doesn't stay on dry land forever, goes back into the lake again. But once it's gone back into the lake, it's got the data of dry land, and then you can understand what water is.
Is it also that the application of that super mindfulness, the process of perception?
That too, yeah. Because you can actually more clear to see how this stream of consciousness, you even say it, call it a stream of consciousness. Really, it should be a stream of consciousnesses. Not a stream of consciousness, a stream of consciousnesses. And that's a much more accurate way.
So
I think it's interesting, I should remind you that, because we call it Vijnana Sota. And Vijnana Sota is a compound. Sota is stream. Vijnana can be singular or plural. So it's actually, it would be really good to change it into the stream of consciousnesses.
Is it like a super awareness
from
that's doing
this? Yeah. From the abandoning of the five hindrances. The fuel of delusion is gone. Ludo.
It's very rare.
Depends. Again, it's sometimes it used to be very hard to say, you know, get a kuti in Vajrayana Monastery. You only had a couple of kutis here. But now there's 21 kutis here, and we've got Jhana Grove as well. So it's much easier to get reborn from a range retreat in Vajrayana Monastery than it was last year. There's more accommodation. More rooms for you. In the same way, human population has increased enormously since the Buddha's time. Literally more wombs to be reborn into. So because of that, it's much easier these days to be reborn as a human being than it was in the time of the Buddha.
But it's still
quite difficult. But it's much easier. Yeah. So that's why I gave a question just to people once. Is it really sort of good karma to have children or bad karma to have children? Sometimes you look at it one way. If you have children, you bring more people into this suffering, stinky old world. So you've got so many people already in this world. It's environmental disaster with a huge population. So in that sense, it's bad karma. But in another sense, you're giving more opportunities for people to take a human birth.
I don't
know. Don't give her ideas. Yeah, you did your job, okay. So you did give rise to more opportunities for people to take rebirth in the human realm. As for me, I'd be totally, totally selfish. And I'd stop people... That's interesting. The Turks has gone down. Only amongst some. Yeah, oh really? Okay, so.
So, facility is actually part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't take into account conditional problems,
Well, I think usually what happens is understanding the nature of craving and, you know, creating worlds. We usually try and create a world which we know, which is similar. So that's why a lot of times people try and create a world which is similar to their known. So if at all possible, they usually will incline to being reborn in the same realm, very often in the same country, in the same sort of religion, even the same sort of cultural place. So the Muslims would mostly be reborn as Muslims. Jews as Jews.
Druze.
Druze as Druze. Yeah, that's right, yeah, they do have that belief as well.
Ajahn, I have a question.
Yeah.
For those monks, including ordination,
they'll be reborn as bhikkhunis in the next line.
why they're not afraid of this kind of possible consequences?
Yeah, well, no, just maybe not go into that on this talk on. this beautiful sort of right view. But no, so sometimes what happens with beings, they make a stand, they take a choice, and they know it's a wrong choice, but they just won't give it up. There's that story which is in the Digha Nikaya of this two people who went to try and seek their fortune. They went into this abandoned area to see if they could find something valuable. And so they found some old hemp. So they both took the hemp, made a bundle with their cross on their head, and they took the hemp back. And then on the way, that someone found some hemp and cloth and said, "This is much better than the hemp." They threw it away and said, "No, I've carried this hemp long enough already. I'm going to carry the hemp." So one guy changed it to a hemp and cloth, and from hemp and cloth to some flax, flax to cotton, cotton to some silk thread to some silk cloth to some silver to some gold. But the other guy said, "No, look, now I've carried this long enough already. It's all packed up. I don't want to change." And so when they came home, one guy came home with this pile of gold. And his family was very happy with him. While the other guy came home with this bunch of hemp on his head. And they just threw him out of the house and chased him away, stupid guy. And there was a Buddhist image that said, why can't we change our views? Because sometimes we've identified with those views. And we just will not give them up.
They pay for
a big
price.
Yeah, well, it's like this guy paid for the stiff price. You know, he got chased out of the village and stupid. And he could have made a lot of money, he didn't. I mean, that was a pretty materialistic simile, but it's a great simile. Why don't give it up? But anyway, that's what I've got to be careful of that. Sometimes I think, am I just protecting or not protecting, but conserving a view simply because I've had it for a long time and because I'm known to have this view, or am I keeping this view because I know it's right? So if I suddenly found out that that jhanas aren't necessary for enlightenment, for example, if I suddenly find that out, I would say that, even though it's embarrassing. "What, Ajahn Brahm, all these years you've told us that jhanas are important and now they're not?" But the honesty would tell me, "Okay, I'm sorry guys, but I made a big mistake." But right now, everything I know, experience say, it is necessary for enlightenment. And I'm not going to carry that on my head if I find something better. You get the point? Yeah, but sometimes we hold on to our views tenaciously, even though some of us know it's wrong.
Like it yourself, coming back to having given. How much time have we spent listening, and we still hold it?
Okay. Anyway, any other questions before we finish off?
I should make an announcement. We have a new washing machine. Please read the instructions.
You got it already?
Yeah, it's installed. We
watched it closed in. How did you get this afternoon? You went straight in and got it.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, gee, I only gave the check just after lunch.
No, he was so happy he killed the check to it.
That is craving. Okay, no, seriously, the reason why we've got a washing machine is not to play around in, but it is wash clothes and over here, because over in Jhana Grove we've got some incredible laundry over there, and some of the monks have been going over there to do their washing.
Save a lot of water.
Save a lot of time. But before you use it, please read the instructions. Don't press the button and go bang and then read the instructions afterwards. The instructions are not there after it goes wrong. The instructions are there so it never goes wrong. So, this is out of our expense account, all those donations of many, many people. How much is 600 and something dollars? Yeah, so please look up. It's got a 10-year warranty, but I did look on it to see if there was any exceptions for use in the monastery. Usually if it's in the monastery, it's only got 5-year warranty or less. Voided. Okay, so it's good there. Well done. Oh, you saw. You're very happy. Very good. Okay.
Now let's take a fresh hour of this. Sadhu, Anumodami.
Very good. So that's a big sutta today, Samaditi. So thank you for restraining yourself with some of the questions. If I went a bit fast, I apologize because a lot to get through. And next Saturday, I won't be here. I'll be in my cave. And the Saturday afterwards, when I come out again, Satipatthana Sutta. And followed last of all by the deepest one of all, the Mudra Pariyaya.